new contract, and it was our desire to try and treat all new contract consistent. I appreciate your desire to treat all your employees consistent,
Yes,
and
sir.
I respect that. It was just our desire to try and treat all new contracts consistently.
All right, so if there is actually any room for you to consider that, then I would appreciate it because I do think it's fair. I don't think it's being disingenuous at all. In my discussions with the leadership in the ACCFT, it was very much our intent to construct what is the moral equivalent of a contract continuation. That is in essence, and it doesn't change the financial terms of the previous contract. And we did that, frankly, to make sure that it would be here in time to be considered along with everything else. So I don't think it's a small point, and I'm not versed on the legalities of it, but if there's room for discussion, I'd like you to just consider that not only does it have all of my folks treated together, and that's important to me, but I do believe that there is a position that says a reasonable person could look at that and say that's not a new contract. That really is, in essence, a continuation. If you chose to do that, I would encourage that. I'll shut up with that, sir.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you're considering a new contract, so it was negotiated for a period of time, and its time is ended or is about to end, and. So do you know, is it being negotiated? Do you know what the amount would be if it would be in here?
Just to specifically exempt out arson where a person has been put at risk. So if a kid burns down the fence in my front yard, that's arson, but nobody has really been put, nobody's life has been necessarily put in danger. If a kid lights my house on fire, though, then that would be one that would be precluded from this type of negotiated community sentencing. So with that, I have any objection or questions? Seeing none, that will be adopted. Then, Representative Davies, I think the only other item that you had brought up yesterday was the definition of community. I think if we just leave the language the way it is, the court is going to be able to define what community means.
I think in most cases you're right, but I just would like to preclude any argument over that. I mean, it still has the undefined term, and it seems to me that the offender may have a particular definition of who he wants to negotiate. Clearly, the court has the upper hand in the sense that they have to approve it, and I think that's right. But I don't think it does any harm to just make it absolutely clear that the court defines who the community is, and so. I would move that on line 13 that we insert a new sentence that says, in this section, community shall be defined by the court.
Representative Dyson, have you given that some thought?
The only thing I would offer as a suggestion is that the court approve who is defined as the community. So that gives both sides, you know, the perpetrator and the victim, a chance to input who they feel the community is, and that the court is in the approving role, which I think still accomplishes your goals, Representative Davies.
One thing I think we want to keep in mind is if you use the word approve, does that necessitate then that the court has to set up a process by which people can come and apply to be considered community, and if so, is there going to be an expense associated with that versus just say it shall be defined by the court? I think it preempts that possibility. Representative Davies?
I would agree with you. On second thought, I agree with what you're saying. And I think that also that you know, we're not forcing anybody into that again because it's both sides have to agree to the process to go forward. So,
Representative Bundy?
Muddle a little more. May be defined by or defined in consultation with that.
Well, I think if it's an instance where the court is going to approve one of these things, then they will define who the community means. We had an example brought up yesterday that in one case, Mothers Against Drunk Driving was determined to be the community that the defendant would negotiate with. And it would only kick in when the judge is going to approve one of these negotiations. Representative Davies?
I just think that we need to explicitly give the court that power, because I can see where there are many, there could be in certain instances many appropriate choices for who would represent the community, and whenever there's more than one choice, there's a possibility for an argument or a lawsuit or an appeal or something like that. If we make it absolutely clear in bright lines that the term community shall be defined by the court, it just eliminates all that possible argument.
Okay, Representative Davies has moved an amendment number 2. Is there objection? Seeing none, then that will be adopted. Any other amendments to come before the committee? Okay, we do have the one indeterminate fiscal note. And I believe, actually, it's probably an indeterminate savings to the state. So at conference committee, we'll jack that up and put a number on it. And Representative Foster.
Are you ready to move it out?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out HD 372 as amended with the attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Okay, that's a House Finance CS. Is there objection to the motion to move the bill? Seeing none, we'll move from committee with individual recommendations. Okay, the next I would like to take up CS. Okay, we'll hand out a CS on the railroad bills that were discussed yesterday. The CS, which is a backslash H, rolls all three bills together. And I have an amendment then to take care of, or actually Representative Bundy has an amendment that is proposed to take care of the concern that came up on the DeLong dock issue. And the amendment is in your House Bill 320 file. So if you would go to that file to pull out the suggested language. And it's got a date up at the top of it, 4600.
In what number?
The proposed amendment language is in the House Bill 320 file.
Mine's on the desktop.
It may be on your desktop.
320 or 325?
320.
320.
It sounded like you were saying 325.
Yeah.
And it's 320
file.
File.
File. I knew.
320.
325?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
This is the time of year that we work on capital budget. You don't want to piss the chairman off now.
I think that should be separate.
Sure.
It's a long one.
Yeah, might have a $20 million
in your mouth.
Okay. Do the members have the backslash H version in front of them? Representative Bundy amendment. Representative Bundy.
If you're ready, I would move amendment number 1.
Hold on. We haven't adopted the H version.
That's right. We need to actually move that as a working document.
Okay, thank you. And then I would move that we withdraw my previous motion and move that we adopt as our working document CS for House Bill 362 Finance. / H, dated 4300.
Object.
There is objection. We'll have discussion.
I move to amend the motion to adopt the / H version without the Whittier portion.
Okay.
Object.
There is objection to the amendment to the motion. Representative Davies, would you like to speak to it first?
I'll let Representative Phillips.
I would like to speak to Representative Davies' motion. I think it makes perfectly good sense to keep the two track alignment bills into one bill, so I don't have any problem with that. However, I do know that there is opposition from the sponsor of one of the major alignment bills, the military one, and from the railroad on putting the DeLong Dock bill into this. And I would like to, if, with the permission of the chair, I'd like to have that on the record. I just spoke with Senator Lehman, who is the sponsor of the military track bill, and he expressed again to me his concern that we not tie in the DeLong Dock bill with this. So I'd like to call a representative from his staff and then from the railroad to speak to him.
From Senator Lehman's staff.
Senator Lehman's staff first and then the railroad.
Okay.
Or Representative Murkowski. Thank you. I didn't see you come in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I stated yesterday, our intent is to make sure that the straightening of the tracks between Anchorage and Wasilla is accomplished with legislation this year. It's very important that things not be held up. The Anchorage voters just overwhelmingly supported their component of it on Tuesday, and we don't want to do anything that is going to jeopardize the success of that legislation. If in fact there are those of you who are sitting either around this table or in the body on either side that think that the DeLong Dock issue is going to snarl up the track straightening, then I would in fact object to it. I don't know what more I can say other than that.
And Representative Phillips, then, do you want a statement from the railroad?
Please.
Wendy?
My statement would mirror Representative Murkowski's statement in that I would also be afraid that if the bills were combined in that fashion, there's always the possibility that you run that they could all three die and that the track alignment bill would not go forward. I do want to state for the record, however, that we do fully support and hope to see the DeLong Dock bill also pass this session.
Mr. Chairman, if I could reiterate that point, because I know that that was a fear of some members that if the two alignment bills got passed, the railroad would not have the commitment to pass the DeLong Dock bill. And Wendy, if you would restate that very clearly, please.
The Alaska Railroad is completely in support of the DeLong Dock bill. We want to see that pass. It will help the economic development in Whittier at this point. It will take a situation that is currently unknown and unsecure and help us all to move forward, especially as the road opens. I think it's important that we just settle this issue and move forward.
Thank you.
Representative Bundy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the railroad support, but they don't have many votes in the legislature, so I don't think that'll make much difference whether the DeLong Dock issue goes forward or not.
Wendy, just for our tape recorded record, if you'd state your position with the railroad, please.
For the record, my name is Wendy Linskoog. I'm the Director of External Affairs for the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
And I think a number of us were just concerned that we have a package that will move everything, try to, as best we can, assure that the entire package makes it through the process and pieces are not dropped off. So that's part of the concern on leaving things separate and why the proposed CS making the combination was brought to the committee. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, then we have a motion to adopt the CS. Representative Davies has moved an amendment to call out the DeLong Dock portion. So we will have a vote on the amendment to the motion. We'll have a brief at ease. Yeah. Okay, we're back on record, and Representative Osterman was not here yesterday and just wanted to get a little bit of the discussion that took place. And now hopefully everybody's up to speed and go whatever you think. So we will have the roll call vote now. This is the amendment to the motion that would pull out the DeLong Dock section. No, the motion was to adopt the CS. The amendment to the motion is to pull out the DeLong first, and then we would have to take a vote on the motion itself.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Osterman?
Yes.
Representative Bundy?
No.
Representative Davies?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Perio?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Okay. Then the language of... Let's see. 320 is removed. So Representative Bundy, your amendment will not have to be offered to this. Well, now we need to pass the motion, the amended motion, which is to adopt the backslash H. Is there any objection to that? Seeing none. Representative Bundy will not be offering his amendment to the CS then. Are there any further questions on the House Finance CS?
Mr. Chairman, if you're ready, I will move that we pass with chainsaw in background. CS for HB 362 Finance as amended from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note. I believe is there one?
I believe it is zero.
Yes.
Okay, it is the zero fiscal note. Is there objection to that motion? Seeing none, then that will be passed from committee, House Bill 362. Now we will take up House Bill 320 then as a separate matter. Representative Bundy, I believe your amendment is drafted to the to the transportation version. We've had discussion on the bill yesterday. We left off with possible amendments. So would you like to move your amendment at this time?
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number one.
Okay. Amendment number one has been moved by Representative Bundy. Members have the language in front of them. Are there questions or objection? Representative Davies?
Objection. Question. With the adoption of that, how does that affect on page 5, that whole subsection B, how does that affect that specific random, the management terms with the one dot? Is it consistent to adopt this amendment and have that specific reference in the bill?
Representative Davies, did you say on page 5?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the H version
right.
Still here.
I was wondering. I didn't have
that. That would always bring it back to the K.
And then, let me see. You're going to take it back to the K.
Go page 5.
Yeah, we're working on the
which
House,
on
House Transportation version of 320.
All right, so it would be on page 2, line 15 through.
Page 2, line 15.
A subsection B, and it refers. There's a specific reference to a document called the quote management terms for the DeLong Doc unquote, which is a document that already exists and has been signed. And we instruct in this. If I read this right, I'm not quite sure if this is right. The way I read it is that if we pass this into law, that we are instructing that to go into effect. And how does the amendment we're just adopting relate to that?
Perhaps it's a question for Wendy. Do you want to answer, or I believe we do have Phyllis Johnson.
The amendment offered by Representative Bundy would supersede that management terms agreement, the one that was signed with on March 22nd.
Reference to that document in here.
Well. The terms agreement that mentions Chugach Alaska Corporation, all other aspects of that document basically pertaining to how the City of Whittier and the Alaska Railroad would set up eventually a management and operating agreement would still be something that the City and the Alaska Railroad would both like to honor. At least I'm speaking for the City there, I should probably
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bundy and then Representative Williams.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this amendment would only affect portion of that management agreement that talks to the first right of refusal, speaks to the first right of refusal. The rest of the management agreement, I think, is in compliance with state law and should not be changed. Not fall under purview of this bill.
Representative Williams?
Yeah. Chugat was in favor of the way that the language is written today in the bill. Was this part of the negotiated settlement, the way that it was written in the bill, with first right of refusal?
I guess I'm not understanding the exact question.
What the amendment is doing is taking away any first right of refusal for management of the dock.
Trying to incorporate all parties, we came up with that language for the management terms, and referring to those terms in the bill is how those two documents relate. And then, as we discussed yesterday, that directly conflicts with the Alaska Railroad's procurement code, so to make the whole bill legal, we need to basically take out that reference, or as Representative Bundy's amendment would do, it would just delete that part of the management terms agreement.
So it wasn't negotiated?
It was part of a negotiation that went
yes.
on with Chugat. And as I stated yesterday, the problem with that is Chugat and the railroad didn't have the power to negotiate on behalf of the legislature.
Didn't have the power to what?
To negotiate on behalf of the legislature and make basically a sole source contract, get approval, legislative approval for a sole source contract.
But their procurement, their code that they work under gives them that right to do that, to negotiate that way?
There's some question, I guess, since the railroad operates under its own procurement code, I guess there's some question in my mind whether they, in fact, can go to a sole source contract without violating their own procedures.
And the testimony we heard yesterday stated that it would be in violation of their procurement codes.
What I'm concerned about is that if this was already negotiated with Chugat, this kind of language, and then we're going to change it, how does that work with Chugat?
Well, I think in the big picture and at the end of the day, at least the bill is following the procurement codes that the railroad has. So we're not doing anything that's outside of law. Because if the bill passed and that language was still in there, people would contest it, or it could be contested, and then we'd be back right to our procurement codes. And in terms of our negotiations with Chugat, we will need to work with them outside of this legislation on anything that we do on down the line in terms of management of the dock or other projects going on in Seward, but we'll have to still lean back on what law has told us to do regarding our procurement codes.
That's fine. I can agree with where we're trying to go with it.
Okay.
But as far as negotiations, Mr. Chairman, you know, if the railroad negotiated and said that they would do this, and Chugach gave up something to get this, you know, I'd like to know what that was.
Representative Davies and then Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to amend on page 2, line 18, after the word consistent, to insert.
We have Representative Bundy's amendment is pending before us.
All right.
Representative Davis.
I'm sorry, I was.
Representative Davies is interested in amendment number 2, but we've got to deal with this one first, so. Representative Bundy's amendment is pending before us. Did you have questions?
Mr. Chairman, I had questions relating to Representative Williams' question. On the management terms for DeLong Dock, that's a document. Who's signed on to that? Has Chugat signed on? Okay. So you negotiated with them, but there was no consummation by signature of any agreement?
Right. The signature.
Go ahead.
Right. The signatures to that document are the City of Whittier and the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and the purpose of the document was just to define on down the line how we could set up a long-term management and operating plan.
Representative Davies.
To be completely clear in that document, it does give the Chugach Corporation first refusal on the management plan.
Right. And that is what we have discovered goes directly against our procurement rules.
Representative Bundy. And I think we have had a legal opinion distributed yesterday from Terry Bannister that would indicate that that first right of refusal is not consistent with the state's procurement code.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't correctly indicated that I can't offer this amendment, but I just, in looking at that and hearing the discussion, I think I have an amendment that if we can adopt that, I'll have no objection to Representative Bundy's amendment.
Yeah, I agree. I know where you're going.
An amendment to the amendment?
No, I have another amendment, but I just want to let the members know that I believe that we can fix the inconsistency.
Okay, so Representative Bundy has moved his amendment.
Consider that, or
do you? Representative Bundy is willing to withdraw his amendment so we can consider. Representative Davies?
And I move to withdraw my amendment.
Okay. Representative Davies?
The amendment that I would propose would be on line 18 of page 2, after the word consistent, to insert the words to the extent possible.
Hey, Representative Davies, this is just. So just on line 18, land as a single unit consistent to the extent possible with the terms contained in the document titled the management terms of the Dillon Dock. Okay, that will be amendment number one. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I completely concur with that amendment because otherwise we're directing and authorizing the management terms of Dillon Dock if we don't do this. So. And there was a conflict. There would have been a conflict with the previous amendment without this.
Okay. Is there objection to the amendment? Seeing none, then amendment number one will be adopted. Representative Bundy.
And I would offer amendment number now, new amendment number two.
So Representative Bundy's amendment needs to be renumbered amendment number two. Is there objection to amendment number two? Seeing none, that will be adopted. And then, Wendy, I just had one question. I'm sorry, my staff may have asked this of you. On page 2, line 15, when you start off with notwithstanding C and H, it seems like C and H sort of outlines a number of things. And I'm wondering, why are you saying notwithstanding?
No, if you have an idea, I would have to refer to our legal counsel on that.
Representative Davies.
Because C and H explain the terms of what happens if B doesn't go into effect.
Oh, okay. Okay, I understand.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, is this Phyllis?
Oh, this is Sherry Beretta. Excuse me. I just wanted to ask when I would be able to speak or testify on this
Let's see, I guess we can take some comments from you on behalf of Chugach right now.
Thank you. I would just like to say that, again, Sherry Beretta, Chugach Alaska Corporation Chairman of the Board, that the issues that were raised regarding the negotiations that took place between the railroad and the Chugach Alaska Corporation were consistent with our right to as much right as the city and the railroad to utilize that the dock, and the negotiations and agreement that we came up with allowed us to have that entrance addressed, and that this is a flap in our face as far as our willingness to withdraw our attempt at going about securing the property through the federal acquisition process. And that I would also like to add that that I just think that this is the stance about the illegality of the language is inconsistent with other issues that have passed through the legislature, and that the comment by Representative Bundy that this language is illegal, that it seems to me that the legislature is the body responsible for passing laws, and that it has the authority and has demonstrated the ability to give preference to organizations that has significant interest, and I am disopposed to this language as it stands.
Thank you. You're right, the legislature certainly has that power. In this case, I guess the indications from the committee members are we don't wish to exercise that power on this piece of legislation. Are there any questions for Ms. Beretta? Representative Davies?
Mr. Chairman, I believe, though, that the language in the bill, as it stands, says that that we expect the railroad and the City of Whittier to execute that management agreement to the extent possible, consistent with the document that was signed. And so that, and it's my understanding and expectation that to that extent possible, that the railroad and the city will try to honor whatever understandings they have with the Chugach Corporation. So I don't think that by doing it in this manner, we've excluded them from the picture. We've just made it meet the technicalities of our procurement codes.
Are there other questions by committee members? Okay, there is the zero fiscal note attached to the committee. We haven't really looked at the fiscal note, but it is zero. Are there other amendments to come before the committee? Just seeing none. Representative Mulder?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I would move that we pass from committee the Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 320 as amended by the committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, the bill will move with individual recommendations. Okay, next I would like to take up House Bill 368. We have Annie Carpinetti with the Department of Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I appreciate your hearing this bill today. The purpose of House Bill 368 is to allow more people who are charged with crimes before trial or who are found guilty of crimes pending sentencing or appeal to be released on bail while they're waiting for their trial or their sentencing proceeding or their appeal to be decided. And it does so by giving the justice system some better tools and more tools to encourage people who are released to abide by any conditions of release that the court might order them to abide by while they're out of jail. There are four main areas where it does this. First, it makes it a crime to violate a condition of release that has been imposed by the court. Now, if a person is released on bail and violates conditions of release, the person may be reincarcerated on the original charge, but there are no additional consequences, and the person would be afforded credit for time served for the time served on the original charge. The municipality of Anchorage and the city and borough of Juneau both have ordinance similar to the one contained in this bill that make it an additional crime, an additional consequence to violate conditions of release. And their experience has been, according to their municipal prosecutors, that it does have a very good effect on encouraging people to abide by the conditions that the court has imposed on their release. The second way it encourages people to abide by conditions of release is it makes some consequences. It clarifies that when a person is released to the custody of a third person who promises the court that he or she will notify the police if the person violates a condition of release, it provides that if the person fails to notify the police when the defendant has violated a condition of release, that they can be found in contempt of court. Custodians don't need to stop the person from violating the condition. All they have to do is call the police or call the court or whoever the judge has asked them to call if the person violates the condition a condition of release. The third way that it encourages people to abide by conditions of release is it specifically authorizes the court to impose performance bonds when they release a person from custody. A performance bond requires a person to pay money into the registry of the court, and on condition that they abide by their conditions of release, they'll get their money back. If they violate their conditions of release, it will be forfeited, or it may be forfeited to the state. Performance bonds have been used in Southeast Alaska and other parts of the state for many years, and they have been an effective tool to encourage people to follow the conditions that the court orders when releasing them. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals just recently found that there is no specific statutory basis for allowing courts to impose performance bonds. So the bill that was drafted and introduced early in the session, we did just to clarify, and it turns out that it's necessary that we clarify it because the court has found that we need specific statutory authority to allow judges to impose performance bonds. It also requires the forfeiture of such security if the person violates a condition of release and that condition was forbidding the person to make contact with the victim of the offense. Forfeiture of the bond would be discretionary if the person violated another condition, for example, leaving a specific area. In Juneau, would be city of borough. That's a pretty common condition of release, that you stay in the city of and borough of Juneau, that you stay in contact with your lawyer. So the forfeiture would be discretionary under those circumstances, but mandatory if the defendant contacted the victim in violation of a court order that he or she not do that. And finally, it makes a rather minor conforming amendment to the statutes. Judges now, when they sentence a person to incarceration, will often order them to report to jail at a later date. And it's often at the request of the defendant. You know, they're fishing or they've got a job and they'd like to serve their term at a more convenient time. Or there's problems, there might be overcrowding at a particular time in the jail, so the court will order the defendant to report at a later time. This gives specific authorization for that practice, which is actually going on right now, but it embodies it in the statute. So that's a general review of what the bill does.
Representative Austin.
Yes. two things. First off, the third party.
Custodian.
How much discussion did have you had on this bill as far as third parties concerned with it? And it doesn't report, but didn't know. I mean, those kind of things where somehow they were taken out of the picture for some reason. Through the violation had occurred, so that they didn't report it.
Well, through the chair, if they didn't know a violation had occurred, they wouldn't be under any responsibility to report it. But when they take responsibility of a defendant, the court will give them conditions of release, and as long as they do what the court asks them to do, then there's no problem. But and most custodians take their job very seriously, and it's a pretty big responsibility to be a custodian. But unfortunately, sometimes there are people who will, you know, agree to act as a custodian and then leave town, or, you know, say, well, I got you out, then go on ahead and let's wait for trial. And it's important that people know that if a person, and the safety of the victim is often at risk here. If a court takes a risk to release somebody and says you may not contact the victim, and it requires the custodian to notify the police if the defendant does contact the victim, it's important that they take that responsibility seriously. They don't have to keep the person from contacting the victim, but they do have to call the police and say this person is violating the conditions of release.
If they know.
Pardon?
If they know.
If they know, correct.
The forfeiture of security, now is that a separate security from being bond for being released, just being released?
Well, there are two types of security. If this bill passes, there would be a performance bond where the court could require a defendant to pay money into the registry of the court on condition and have it returned if they abide by the conditions. There are also appearance bonds too, which is like your traditional bail bond. And if a person fails to show up when they're supposed to, then that could be forfeited too.
So there could be an appearance bond and the security bond.
And a performance bond. That's correct, through the chair.
Okay. Are there further questions for Department of Law, Representative Davies?
I guess I've heard some from some of the bail bonds folks that they're concerned about being able to predict what the cost of their bond, you know, how much they have to charge in order to provide the insurance, and they're concerned about I think more the collateral requirements that, you know, maybe you go to an alcohol program or you don't go to a bar or some those kinds of things, and that those become much more problematic. Now, you've indicated that those are discretionary, but I gather there's still a fair amount of angst out there about how this is going to impact the ability of people to even get bonds if there's a possibility that relatively minor violations the order, the court's order, might result in losing the entire bond.
Through the chair.
In the area of discretion, is it discretionary only to lose the entire bond or just a portion of the bond? I mean,
It would be discretionary to lose whatever amount of the bond that was posted or to lose it at all.
So there is a gradation possible in there, too.
Sure. And I would say, at least the experience that with performance bonds that we have, and it's mostly in the First Judicial District where they have been imposing them, we really have never had bail bondsmen here. Sometimes the bail bondsmen from Anchorage will write bonds for people, but they could be appearance bonds, and they could be separate from performance bonds. And so that I suppose a bondsman could post a bond for a person to appear, but not to abide by conditions of release. And the
in that case, the person wouldn't get released then, right?
Well, through the chair, the courts. This is just another tool in the bag of tools that a court can use, but. At least in Southeast Alaska, judges could tailor the amount of the performance bond to an amount that the person could come up with him or herself or his family, so that you wouldn't have large amounts being required for performance bonds, but enough to give the individual some financial incentive to abide by the conditions of release.
But you can't distinguish between in the amounts, we don't have the ability to distinguish between the mandatory and the discretionary parts. Is that correct?
In
other words, I'm much more interested in the no contact piece of it than I am the rest
of
it.
Sure, okay.
And right now, we can't distinguish between those two.
Well, the bill provides that if you do contact a victim in violation of a performance bond, then the security will be forfeited.
Right, but you in order to set the bar high with respect to contact, you have to set it high with respect to these other things. Is that right?
Oh, I'm sure that a court could have the creativity to set at different levels. Generally, they say it's set for the same, but for forfeiture, the court could look at whatever violations there
were. They still have discretion within that.
Sure.
Oh, I see. that was violated, what has to happen to know that a person was in fact in violation? And just a simple assertion, is that all that's required, or is there some proof required?
I believe that the standard proof is by a preponderance of evidence. But in terms of the crime, it would be beyond a reasonable doubt. The crime that's embodied in this bill, the state would be obliged to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person violated the condition.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms of, you know, violation of a bail condition, it would be different.
Other questions for the Department of Law? Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Annie, one quick question. When reading the bill and the letter from the governor, I just want to clearly put on the record that when a person signs on as a third-party custodian, currently they assume some responsibilities. Under this, the only additional responsibilities or penalties placed upon a third-party custodian would be in the event that if the person that they are overseeing disappears or is no longer in their custody, they have to report it.
That's correct.
Within a 24-hour period, or how long?
Well, the bill says immediately, and it really depends on the circumstances. If the person, for example, is supposed to be in the house at 10 o'clock, probably immediately is that night, not the next morning.
Right.
But maybe not 10:30, you know.
And the only change from current practice in practicality with this bill from current, practice is the fact that while it's generally understood that they're supposed to do that anyway, there's an enforcement or there's a hammer included here, correct? And that is that if they don't, then they're subject to a penalty as well?
They could be found in contempt of court, yes, and penalized for that.
Okay, generally speaking, I looked at that and I had some concern if we were going to discourage people from becoming third-party custodians, because that's a very necessary part, as you well understand. And I didn't want to discourage it, but if, on the other hand, all we're doing is making certain that they fully understand what the obligation to which they're signing up for, and that there is some enforcement that goes along with it, then I think it's good.
They don't have to, hold them back from leaving the house or doing anything, but they just have to call and let the authorities know that they violate.
That was the part that I was concerned about, because there might be a circumstance where the person has flight, beyond the control of the custodian, And, I could see a scenario where you would, it'd be a strong discouragement from people becoming a third-party custodian in that circumstance.
Other questions? Is there anyone? Oh, we do have Blair McCune on line to testify. Mr. McCune?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair McCune. I'm Deputy Director at the Office of Human Security. I'd like to go ahead and make a few comments about the bill, if I could.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're really concerned about this bill. We're afraid it's going to gum up the works. Prison overcrowding is obviously a problem in Alaska, and it just doesn't involve just sentenced prisoners, but a big portion of the people in jail at any given time are people awaiting trial or other proceedings. If this number increases, it'll have pretty serious consequences for prison overcrowding. We put in a fiscal note in the bill. We did one quick study just to see how many arraignments and bail hearings we did in a given period. I think we did over 330 in a 10-day period. So this is a large part of what we do is doing bail hearings, and it's really important for people who are charged with misdemeanor offenses to be able to, especially misdemeanor or more minor felony offenses, to be able to get out of jail pending a trial or sentencing. The main parts of the bill we're concerned about is the one on performance bonds and then the new offense of violation of the conditions of release. I would disagree respectfully with Ms. Carbonetti when she said that there's no additional consequences for someone if they violate a condition of release. Actually, there are, in my view. When a judge releases somebody, usually it's that same judge or another judge of the same court is going to sentence the person if they are convicted of a crime. And believe me, the sentence is much harsher if a person violates a condition of release. They're not going to be considered for probation. the actual sentence that's put out, often not going to be considered for probation if they can't follow the rules when a sentencing is coming up in a case or a trial. And going back to jail itself is certainly an additional consequence. Ms. Carbonetti, I know, practices mostly in jail, but we do have bondsmen write appearance bonds in many other areas of the state, especially in Anchorage. These bonds are, the bondsmen write them because they're fairly predictable. They know whether somebody will appear or not. If they don't, the bondsmen have ways of persuading them to come into court quickly. I don't think that the private bondsman will write any of these performance bonds. I just don't see them taking the business risk to do that. That'll leave people either in jail or with some type of bond that has to be put up in cash or a percentage of a cash amount, usually by family members and friends. And we're concerned that we have third-party custodians were put in the bail statute. But, you know, a number of years ago, it seems like they're routinely written in every case. We're concerned that performance bonds will also be very prevalent and add additional work and additional barriers to having people released. People who are in jail and facing bail aren't in a great bargaining position. They're not going to be able to say, well, I would rather not have this or not have that. Family members and friends who want their loved one out of jail are also going to put up money and have to put up money. And we're afraid that this will... Now, there's so many conditions of release in so many cases. Ms. Carbonetti referred to the curfews and the area limitations, being in bars, not being in an automobile, things like this. We're afraid that this will cause a real hardships on families that really can't afford it. The other consequence, which I had just thought about, which I think is an important one, is if family members and friends who are also third-party custodians put up money as a performance bond, on pledging that that the person who is released, the defendant, criminal defendant, won't violate conditions, and they're also under a duty to report any violation condition, there'll be a bondsman that I talked to was saying that he'd be afraid that people would not report because of the money at stake. And now, as it is, the third-party custodians, report by calling into the on-duty magistrate and so on without any money consequence to the money they might have put up on a performance bond. Turning to the violation of conditions of release, I'd restate what I said about the consequences of violating conditions of release. They are real and big consequences as it is now. We're concerned about violations of conditions of release kind of being a plea bargaining tool in many cases. In other words, someone might have a triable case and they're awaiting trial and there's delays in the trial. A curfew violation comes up. They're being charged with a Class B misdemeanor. Violation of conditions of release is a Class A misdemeanor. The plea bargaining pressure on somebody to when they're facing a Class A misdemeanor, that might be dismissed if they're plea to the Class B misdemeanor that they're going to challenge. That type of pressure being brought on defendants is something that we think could happen in this new law that we wanted to inform the committee about. So we're real concerned about the law, and we think that the present system, although not the greatest in some ways, is a fair system, and people are being released who needs to be released and that we don't need this law to add to the. We're afraid that this new law will have difficulties and cause a lot of problems in the new system that isn't necessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Blair. Representative Phillips has a question for you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I misunderstood something that you said early on, but when you said that you didn't agree with Ms. Carbonetti's comments on violating, that there would be no impact on violating the condition of release. But do I understand from your opening remarks, where you have a real problem with this bill, that you actually did not support penalties when people violated their conditions of release?
Through the chair, Representative Phillips, we do not support the Section 3, the new law making it a misdemeanor in itself to violate conditions of release.
So, and that's what I wanted to get at. So if a person violates their condition of release, you think they should go unpenalized?
Through the chair, Representative Phillips, they're generally not unpenalized. What happens is that they're brought back into court. If the violations are relatively minor ones, if it's a curfew violation, they come in at 10:30 rather than 10 o'clock, the judge might give them a stern talking to and say, don't do that again. If it's something much more serious, obviously like contacting a victim, they'll be put back in jail. That's consequence one. If they're found guilty of the charge they're out on bail for, they're going to have to go in front of that same judge and say, Judge, can you give me probation? Can you suspend some of the time you're going to impose to give me probation? I'll follow conditions of probation. And the judge is much less likely to believe that they're a good candidate for probation if they can't follow the conditions of release. So there are consequences already within the charge itself that are the main, it seems to me, motivating factor for people to follow these conditions of release, other than family members and coercion.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Blair? If not, thank you for your testimony. Are there any other individuals on teleconference who wish to testify on this bill? Hearing none, are there any other individuals in the audience who wish to testify? Hearing none, Annie, I know you have some final comments that you'd like to respond.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments. When I said there were no consequences, there are no additional consequences besides what would be there on the original charge, which is, you know, in the worst scenario, they'd go back to jail, but they would get credit for time served under those circumstances. Mr. Blair made a comment that a person might be charged with a B misdemeanor and face the prospect of an A misdemeanor for violating a condition of release, but I think that's incorrect. The bill provides that if you are charged with a felony and you violate conditions of release, and you are convicted of violation of conditions of release, that's a Class A misdemeanor. But if you're charged, if the underlying charge that you're being released on is a misdemeanor, then and you violate conditions of your release and you're convicted of that violation, it would be a Class B misdemeanor. So you wouldn't be getting a Class A misdemeanor if you're originally released on a B misdemeanor. Those are the comments I just wanted to clear up. Thanks.
Representative Davies.
Isn't there another additional consequence if you establish this new bond procedure?
Through the chair, this encourages people to abide by conditions of release in two ways, well, in several ways. First of all, it provides consequences for a person not taking seriously their duties as a third-party custodian, so they'll take, we hope that they'll take it, most of them do take it pretty seriously, but we hope that everybody will. This provides for the possibility of being charged with another crime if you violate conditions of release, and it also provides for monetary consequences if you violate conditions by forfeiting a bond that you have posted promising to abide by your conditions of release. And in terms of prison crowding, the purpose of this bill is to allow more people to be out than overcrowding the jails.
Representative Davies?
I guess I'm wondering why you feel like you need both the additional sort of civil penalty, if you will, and the criminal penalty as well.
Through the chair, it's important to public safety that people who are released pending trial abide by their conditions of release. Judges impose these conditions for the safety of the public and for the safety of the victim, and in some cases for the safety of the defendant, him or herself. And We think that the more tools that the court has to encourage their abiding by their conditions, the better.
So is it your expectation that the charging of this new violation, misdemeanor, would only occur in the more serious cases of violation of the terms?
Be the chair, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're making decisions on allocating resources, you'd be much more concerned with contacting a victim than, you know, being a half hour late on your curfew.
Are there any further questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you. Annie, do you know, are there any statistics at all about if a person, depending on their economic status, if I had my last $500 and I had to put it up for bond, would I be less likely to flee than if I had $10,000 and I put $500 up? There seems to be a concern about the poorer people by the public defender as opposed to someone maybe with that's not so poor.
Through the chair, I don't know that we have statistics on that particular issue, but we do know that judges are perfectly capable of analyzing a person's or looking at a person's resources and making the bond appropriate to what would be important to that person to lose.
Are there any further questions for Annie? None. Are there any amendments on this bill? Hearing none, take a look at the fiscal notes. The AG's office has provided a zero fiscal note. Department of Corrections has an indeterminate fiscal note. And the Public Defender's Office has provided a $38,000 fiscal note. Is there any discussion of the fiscal notes or debate? Hearing none, what is the will of the committee?
Chairman.
Representative Bundy.
I move we move from Finance CS for House Bill 368 Judiciary with attached fiscal notes. Individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill will move from committee. The next bill we will take up will be House Bill 441. And to spare the committee, since they hear from me every day.
Object.
No.
And to allow a much better public speaker than myself the opportunity, I would call President Hamilton to address the bill. Welcome, President Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my comments very brief. First of all, I think this is an innovative and interesting way to move forward on the necessary funding for the university. I like very much the flexibility that such a bill will allow to include the facility that it will allow us to make greater commitments to the business folks in the state. Being able to move over a two-year period helps your planning process. In that sense, I believe that the amounts actually represent more money than they would be given under normal circumstances. One of the most important things it does that we are already reaping benefits from at the university is that it demonstrates legislative commitment. It demonstrates that the state intends to support post-secondary education in the state of Alaska. This commitment in no small way is responsible for some absolutely magnificent signs throughout the university. I'll just share two of those that I directly attribute to the fact that the funding last year was a plus up and the rhetoric this year has been even more significant. Last year at this time, we had 210 of our Alaskan scholars, top 10% of the high school graduating classes. 210 had indicated their intent to come to the university at this time. Actually, 275 showed up.
This year to date, we've had 546 indicate their intent to come, which tells me that next year, for what is quite likely the first time in the history of the state or territory, more than half of Alaska's brightest high school graduates are going to come to their state university. So I think the commitment by this body and this committee has been important in doing that. Lest we are too concerned that it's all about giveaway, let me add that our first-time freshman applications, again, over the same time last year, are up 30%. So that kind of commitment is not just gratuitous, it is negotiable. We think it's important that the bill includes accountability measures. That's been my personal and professional commitment to this committee and to this body. Frankly, I think that accountability measures can only make the university more understandable, more focused, more disciplined, and frankly, look better. I would urge a change to the existing document, and that simply deals with the fact that it would certainly be my intent, although I would not have the authority to do so without the change I'm to recommend, it would be my intent, if this bill were to become law and this were to become the university's budget, to pay from that same sum the salary increases agreed to on our ACCFT contract. My faculty deserve those raises, and I would ask for no more money to do that, but simply to have included your approval of that contract so that I might distribute well-earned raises to my faculty. As I say, this would require no more dollars. But I just think this is innovative and enlightened. Would dearly love to test drive a two-year budget with annual accountability. And I think it has great promise, and I salute the authors of this this important commitment to Alaska's future.
Very briefly, President Hamilton, before we have a couple questions, could you talk a little bit about the new programs that you are anticipating bringing online to address the emerging needs, economic needs of the state?
We're bringing programs online in some direct service areas. These do not address emerging but long-term existing requirements. They are in the production of quality teachers for the state of Alaska, the production of two-year nursing graduates, several allied health fields. In vocational areas, if one were not to consider the allied health fields vocational, which I certainly do, areas in heavy equipment operators, very important. We intend to bring online additional opportunities in a growing and evolving logistics area, as well as in an area that currently resides under the rubric of what is little more than a buzzword, but it's called informatics, which just has to do with the analysis and the packaging and the marketing of especially remotely sensed data. Additionally, the bringing on board of a finance degree offering. When you have the highest rated student investment club in the nation, and they appear on CNN and on U.S. News and World Report, it's a little embarrassing to admit that you actually don't give out a finance degree. We just have this club, but we're going to take care of that one. Those are some, among others.
Could you specifically address, General Hamilton, the request by many school administrations around the state for the continuation of a four-year program to help relieve some of the immediate needs they have with providing adequate numbers of teachers, and how that fits into the juxtaposition of the 5 years.
With the 5 year program, yes, let me comment on that. First of all, it is very, very clear what we are directed to do. This is a state university, and we're directed to do a 4 year program, we're to do it. Let me tell you why that's not onerous in any sense. We faced in beginning about 3 years ago the very, very difficult and unfortunate dilemma, because it doesn't have to be a dilemma unless dollars are in such short supply that you simply must pick one or the other. And the classic dilemma of, do we do quality or you do quantity? The quality piece, and they need not be exclusive, but there are some very practical reasons why there's some trade-off there. Trying to get in parallel and in concert with the Alaska Quality Schools Initiative, the intent was, let us produce teachers who, before they even enter the fifth year program, have secured a bachelor's degree in a specific discipline, and in addition have passed the praxis, therefore we know them to be highly qualified teachers, so we have tested students being taught by tested teachers. And that was the intent. There was a thought at the time, frankly, that this would produce one additional year of graduate level tuition. So there was some income that influenced this decision. There was, at that time, because there de facto has always existed the potential of a student with a bachelor's degree to take an additional year and get the certification, that there was the potential to merge those two programs and save a faculty position or two. Under those circumstances, and because I don't feel comfortable in criticizing history, I mean, I wasn't there, didn't make the decisions, don't know everything that was on the table, but those are clearly some characteristics. With additional funding, I mean, as far as that goes, without additional funding, directed to do that by the legislature, we clearly have been directed to do so, we will offer a four-year program. And it is certainly true that since we have announced our single track to a five-year program, the cards and letters of discontent have made us sit up and take notice. And what I would not prefer to abandon the five-year program. I think it's an excellent idea. I think it's going to serve significant portions of this state. I would choose to address the legislative intent by having a four-year program in addition to the five-year program.
Thank you, President. Representative Phillips and then Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, I was extremely encouraged by President Hamilton's remarks as he closed his remarks on the legislature addressing a two-year budget. Thank you very, very much. I have a biennial budget bill that I've been trying to get out of this body, and I appreciate that endorsement very much.
Representative Williams.
Yeah. I wasn't here at the time, but there was a comment made by one of our witnesses or testifiers that had they known that this teacher came from the University of Alaska, they would not have hired that person. But then we're going to invest more money into this type of school?
Well, let's not invest, Representative Williams, any more money into the type that this individual described. Let's invest it in the type that you and I, as citizens of the state, demand, and that is to produce.
What are we doing about it now?
What we're doing about it now is a complete revamping of the program, as we've mentioned with the five-year. This is a matter of hiring the right faculty to teach the right subjects involved with the school districts, so that you aren't deciding what teachers ought to be in a vacuum, but that you're spending your time talking to the people who do this for a living.
Are we there now?
This moment?
Revamping?
this moment, we are not anywhere near where we want to be. Are we improving? Absolutely, we're improving.
Yeah. I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned, you know, as far as the $34 million goes, you know, we're trying, and maybe you can talk to, I appreciate it if you would, talk to the fact that, you know, something's broken, apparently, in the university when, but I can't remember who made those comments. I was watching the TV the other day, and it struck me. I mean, that this person would say that. It had to do with the with education. It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when something's wrong in my house, I go and try to fix it before I go out and add more money or throw money at it. And that's what I'm looking at right now. It reminds me of what we're trying to do is we're trying to fix a broke thing by throwing more money at it. And I would hopefully you can reassure me on that that's not happening.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Williams, I assure you that we don't throw precious dollars at anything. I do believe that that there are many of the changes that that need to be made that do not specifically relate to throwing or even wisely utilizing money, that some of the things that need to change have to do with getting out and getting involved in the local schools so you rebuild that confidence. There has been a significant shaking of the confidence in the education programs at the university. At least some stem from an enduring myth that had to do with the loss of NCATE accreditation by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. That did not mean it lost its accreditation for teaching. No other university or campus in the state even had an NCATE. Great failure on the part of the university not to have dealt with that publicly. Because if you take the time to read the report, and I have, what you discover is this is a choice in the morphology of the department and an argument. NCATE has the absolute right. They're the ones with the accreditation. They don't like the way this is arranged with a separate element for preparation of rural teachers. They have the authority to withdraw their accreditation. And if we decide that that's the best way that we can do this, that's the best structure for us, we have the right to say, well, then fine, go ahead and do it. This wasn't a white glove test. They came and said you failed. As a matter of fact, the very report that removed the NCATE accreditation specifically praised the quality of the faculty and the quality of the student. This thing is not broken, about to go under in any sense. It has been wounded in public opinion, and it takes you a very long time to get that back. The way you get that back is you become a lot less isolated and get involved with the community. But our need to produce the majority of the teachers in this state is fundamental to the long-term support of the university in terms of the recruitment of future students, the recruitment of future faculty positions. I mean, there is a critical mass that most state university systems have long ago reached, where they have become this primary instrument and have all of the benefits of the support out there from a majority of the teachers, principals, and superintendents in the state. We have 15% of our superintendents in this state. 30% of our principals come from the university system, and they tend to prefer to hire faculty from where they came from. And if where they came from wasn't from the university, you start yourself in a little death spiral. So we need to get over that hump and get a hold of them. But these are not broken, staggering, no-count departments. There are some that have a bad reputation because we failed to take aggressive public relations action on the loss of an accreditation that has ever since been depicted and whispered incorrectly as being some foul black mark. It probably was an error in judgment. It's pretty evident. It's cost us mightily. But it was not a matter of incompetence or malfeasance in any sense of the word on the part of the university. We just failed to go out and do that.
Representative Bundy?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, President Hamilton, the university is a complex, multi-headed hydra, if you will, organism that, and historically, even internally, or perhaps especially internally, schools of education haven't been held in particularly high esteem. And I know where you're going, I would agree with you that the final accreditation that's really important is parents and schools of Alaska. And I would like to acknowledge that I think, based on what's happening, information that I've received from other states and other colleges, that you are definitely going in the right direction. And the teacher quality and training in subject area, particularly for middle and secondary school teachers, is now, according to the late, of course, educational research changes with wind sometimes too, but the latest research is that that is one of the greatest single determinants for successful teaching, in that the outcome is students who have acquired specific skills or knowledge. And with that in mind, and I've had conversations with Ms. Redmond, that there is a national organization that I think would be interested in working with the university system on teacher quality, and I hope that you're able to take advantage of that resource. Not that you're unable to do it by yourself, but all the tools that are available, might as well use them.
Sure.
I think you're going in the right direction with the fifth year. If we want to look at the medical model, we certainly don't take someone with a basic biology degree and say, here's a scalpel. Learn as you go.
Yes, sir. No, I understand fully.
Are there any, President Hamilton, I know that I handed you earlier a question that one individual had made about the logistics program, and
yes,
some of us had just come from a presentation by the AEDC and other members, Siri, talking about a new military logistics center on Fire Island outside the port of Anchorage, and it was very exciting, the opportunities there. Could you address the logistics program that we currently have and what you envision for the future?
Well, I think logistics writ large has just an enormous potential in the state, and again, I have a document where I have one of my professors who chose not to write to me, but at least he got it out here, that says, I don't think you're right. I don't think there's much of a future in the logistics program. I would note that Anchorage is already number two in the global exchange of parts and parcels as an airport and tonnage, and Fairbanks is number nine. So it seems to me that the free market thinks that this is a really good place to do this sort of stuff. The industries within the state have also made that kind of free market commitment. When FedEx and UPS and Linden and Tote cumulatively give to the university just shy of $1 million over the next 3 years to expand the logistics program, I think this is fairly literally putting your money where your mouth is. So they think that there is a need to have a strong university to provide that kind of training. In our discussions with the military logisticians, and they are extensive and continuing, there's a great deal of interest in the possibility of utilizing, in essence, outsourcing their logistics school. They're certainly willing to talk about this. I'm going to a conference sponsored by Association of the United States Army in May in Richmond to address some of these issues, and as a matter of fact, I've been told by the president of the AUSA and his executive vice president that they're strongly considering Anchorage as the next global logistics conference site, so we'll have a chance to talk to these folks just face up. We train thousands of people a year in the armed forces. They are the greatest movers of large parts and parcels globally, and utilize as many professional logisticians as any major industry. They are therefore an appropriate customer to go after. Nobody's ever approached them before, and their reaction is has been very, very good at all levels. I think the chances of our getting spin-offs to this is at least as exciting as providing the trained workforce. And I want the trained workforce. I'm not talking about the master's degree. There's many, many more fold at the bachelor's and many more than those at the associate. And then at the bottom of this pyramid, there's a whole bunch of skilled operators that need to be trained, and we train more of those than any other organization in the state. So we're looking at the whole industry. We're also looking at the potentials of the spin-offs of this. And that's the light assembly operation. When you are where we are, you're in the perfect place to be in a light assembly operation, because you're simply closer to the varying sources, various sources of the piece parts, quite literally in the center of the globe. I think we would be hard-pressed to exaggerate the impacts that this geographical location will have on the state of Alaska in the next 10 years. It's hard to articulate what they'll be.
Are there any further questions for the president?
Representative Williams. You probably gave us this information before, but if you could tell me, I could go back and find it. But what are you going to use the extra money for again? Do you have it written down in a plan?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay.
We do.
And you did give it to us.
Yes, I did. But I will be delighted to give you the first copy if this were to become law. This certainly would not, this changes everything. It would change with the opportunity to go over 2 years. You'd have a different, you'd probably have, and it's a lesser sum of money. It's a relatively significant lesser sum than the programs we had outlined. So you have to do some prioritization there in the program. My inclination would certainly be not, I don't want to do the Solomon solution and say, let's do two-thirds of every program. I think you do all of the top two-thirds in terms of priorities, and that would be based on the needs of the state. So that's probably what we do. But it would differ because that is the programmed expenditure of a 16.9 million increase. So it would be modified. But there's not going to be any new candidates that I'm aware of.
President Hamilton, in relation to your request to include ACCFT in the package,